You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swabey. Listen to conversations with award-winning filmmakers, directors from the golden age of television, and creatives from the indie film community who continue to inspire the next generation of filmmakers. And now, over to your host, Damian Swabey.
Hi, Hallie. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing absolutely fine. I've had a great day. Everybody loves having a great day. I'm sure I'm not lying when I say that. And here I am now speaking to you about your work, how you got started, why you're doing it, and everything along those lines. So I'm having a good day, and I'm looking forward to hear more from you about what you do exactly.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm really excited to be here to talk with you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I really do. But I'm really interested to know, what makes someone become a writer, producer, and lead in their first feature film? Because doing one of the three is really, really difficult, in my opinion. And so many people have tried, but it hasn't quite worked in various different ways, depending on what people want. Some people want different results. Some want film festival results. They want distribution. They want more recognition. But you yourself, you have put it out there and it's available for all of us to watch. Even me over in the UK could go on Amazon Prime and watch this beautiful, really interesting film called Last Seen in Idaho. So tell us the story about that and why you decided to take the situation by the scruff of the neck and become a writer, producer, lead actress in the film.
I always loved making little short films myself on the VHS camcorder, but I didn't really grow up in an area. I grew up in a small town, and I don't know if you grew up in a small town or the city.
I grew up in South London, so a small part of it, but not by no means was it a small town.
Okay, so you would have had maybe more opportunities available in the city to try different things. I guess it would depend so much on your personal circumstance and your interests at that time. But in a small town, there's like no local theater. There's like even the drama department at the high school, we didn't have a stage. And so I was a lot more focused on sports and academics. But on the side, I was always kind of doing these other creative things. There just wasn't really a creative community where I grew up. And so I didn't actually go to my first acting class until my senior year of college. Or I had always really wanted to, and finally I was like, I'm doing this, you know? So I walked into that class and with a lot of freshmen and sophomores, and that was kind of the beginning. But Last Seen in Idaho was my third feature that I had written or produced. It was my first time though, as you said, playing the lead. I had acted in other people's films. And when I say our films, I'm referring to films that were made by Fireshoot Productions, which is the production company that I own with my partner and husband as well, Eric Cawley. He's a director. So that was our third feature. And, you know, the first film we did, I was focused more on writing. I was co-writing that script. It was a little kind of horror comedy called GPS. It was about GPS treasure hunting, and they don't find what they expect to find. They find Polaroids of a woman tied up and pleading for help, and they don't know if it's a game or it's real. And so I played a very small role in that, acting-wise. And then the next feature that our company made was a little World War II drama called The Last Rescue. And that was more of an ensemble. So I was one of the characters in the main ensemble. But I wrote that with another writer and produced that and also edited that as well with Eric and another editor. And so then by the time we were making our third, then I guess that was the point where I felt, I guess ready is probably the right word, to play the lead, and just really excited to do that as well. And we had a great cast that played other lead roles, Casper Van Dien and Wes Ramsey and Sean Christian. So I guess I felt like I'd, you know, I'm always looking to grow and improve, but I also felt like I'd kind of, you know, put in the work and was just ready.
put in the work, and you certainly was ready. But in the film itself, I wondered what drew you to the character Summer? What drew you to play this role?
Well, I wrote that script. So it's always an interesting thing when you're writing a role that you intend to play. And I did write that role intending to play that. I don't write every script intending to play the lead or even necessarily a specific character. It happens in different ways. But I wrote that. So that was one of the first scripts I ever wrote. So I didn't go to film school. I got an English degree from a university. And then I just started taking improv acting classes and getting involved in the local film community in the Seattle area. I live in Washington State. So I taught myself screenwriting in a lot of ways, read a lot of screenwriting books, read a lot of screenplays, like really good screenplays. Like I got early on, I got my hands on The Blacklist, or, for those that aren't familiar with that is, it's like the list that circulates around Hollywood of what the agents and managers consider to be the best unproduced screenplays. And so I got my hands 1 year on like all the screenplays on The Blacklist. So those are very useful to read. And then I also would just watch movies and like make outlines of the structure in like Excel spreadsheets and just sort of kind of do my own studying and homework on that. And then of course, writing is a big piece of that. So I wrote that screenplay, gosh, really early on, and it was really bad. I was actually doing some organizing in my files about a year ago, and I came across like one of the early versions of it. It's a completely different story. So what we ended up eventually making was like a page one rewrite of it. But the reason I said I wanted to play that character is I just had this idea of this concept of this woman who sees this missing person flyer with her name and her face on it, and what could be done with that would be interesting. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, there's a lot of ways that could go. And the way that it went in earlier incarnations of the story was different than how, you know, it ended up in the version that we shot. But I just I just thought that the type of character that would fit well in this story was somebody who was tough and resourceful, and I wanted to play that. And I also, you know, I grew up playing sports, and I was excited to do, you know, the minor action stuff that we did, the fights and the running and all of that.
The relationship between your character Summer and her sister. Now, as you're a writer and you're so heavily involved with the film, did you draw from your own family experiences? Do you have siblings to draw from when you're writing something like that and performing the lead character?
Well, whenever I'm writing, it's always different what I'm drawing from. I mean, sometimes you are drawing from your own life or your experiences. Sometimes you're drawing from things you've seen, you know, your friends go through, and sometimes, you know, you're inspired by music and just your imagination. In the case of this, I really wanted there to be a sister relationship, and I do have a sister who I'm very close to, but my sister isn't really anything like Trina. So I wouldn't say that, no, I like drew from my sister to write Trina. My sister's also older than me.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was definitely some conflict between Summer and her sister Trina, but there's a lot of love there. You could say, yes, my sister and I love each other, and I would drive to Idaho, you know, if I had to. I won't give anything away either, I guess. But yeah, she's not based on my sister, though, but my sister's awesome. Hi, Lindsay.
I'm sure she is awesome. I'm sure she is awesome. And the character playing your sister and the other characters involved in the film and the crew, I mean, indie film is as hard as it gets, you know, sometimes, and everybody needs to kind of chip in and help out. Most indie films that are really good, in my opinion, has many people involved that wear many hats. Did the crew and did the cast help out in any way possible that on, say, a Hollywood production, they wouldn't be expected to?
Yeah, always. I feel like when you're on a film of that size, it's just really this huge team effort. The film that we're currently in post on is the fifth film that our production company has made. So if we talk about the, you know, in terms of five films, there's really been four that were, all five have been indie films. One of those, however, and I know you'll ask me about this later, is Bayou Caviar, which was a film with Cuba Gooding Jr. It was his directorial debut. So that one was a little larger in terms of budget and scope. It was shot in New Orleans with a union crew. The other four, you know, were smaller indies. So they're all Indian scale. So especially on the smaller four, yeah, it's people are just always pitching in and just excited to be part of the process. And that also is the feeling, it extends beyond cast and crew as well to just the people that help you with resources, especially when you're shooting outside of LA. It's not like everybody's coming to your door and wanting to use your house as a location or borrow something. Like it's, we've shot three films in Washington. Our company has one in Alabama and one in New Orleans. And we're Washington natives. So it people really get excited when we're shooting something. And so they want to help out. So yeah, you've got cast members that sometimes, you know, on their day off are still showing up to help out in this way or that way.
Beautiful.
And you've got crew that the departments are smaller. So you've got crew that really help each other out as well. And everyone just, it's so important to me that the sets are really positive places. That's one of the things that we really emphasize. We just try to work with like good people. But I mean, at the same time, it's a professional set. There's specific departments. These people are experienced in what they do. It's just that the departments are smaller is kind of how I would describe it. So that people end up helping each other out more just because the size of the team is just smaller overall. And everybody gets to know each other really, really well because there's overlap more.
Completely understandable. Everybody eating together, maybe at times, or maybe you had French hours when you were filming. I'm not sure, but I can see how that overlap creates more of a family environment instead of potentially crew versus cast or vice versa in that way. But you also, which really, really stood out to me, is the fact that you're a co-editor.
Yes. So I co-edited The Last Rescue, which was the World War II film, and Last Seen in Idaho, which we were talking about, the thriller. And then I've co-edited the film that we're finishing right now, a comedy called Bigfoot Killed My Wife. So I spent the very first feature we ever did, GPS, Eric edited that with another editor named Paul Preos, and I was in the editing room for so much of that. So I feel like I wasn't an editor, but I was observing that process and involved in that. And after that time, I started doing more like commercial editing and things like that. So when it came time to edit The Last Rescue, I was already thinking in my head as I was writing to more like an editor as well. And I just knew the application as well. I mean, I could easily make my way around the editing software. And so, yeah, I was part of the 3-person team on that. But I do a fair amount of editing now.
I can imagine. And when you say commercial editing, what exactly do you mean by that? By some of our listeners that may not understand.
Yeah, just in between the feature films that we make, we get hired by companies sometimes to make, there's been TV commercials, web videos, corporate in-house videos. But I also edit behind the scenes. So if you were to watch the behind the scenes featurettes on the DVD of The Last Rescue or Last Seen in Idaho, all those featurettes I edited, or like social media teasers, trailers, I edit trailers. So those things as well.
But one thing I will say back to the editing process is it's one thing to be a co-editor and edit with someone else, an editor that's maybe been editing for years. But how did you find actually being an editor on one of your other projects?
Smaller projects, those go pretty fast. And they're just kind of, it's just kind of work, you know, like if you're doing a corporate edit. When it comes to features, that's a whole other different thing because you're telling a story. Mm. And honestly, I have a love-hate relationship with editing. It's a very obsessive, isolating thing to be sitting in a dark room editing for hours and the time just slips away.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I really like it because you have such an input into that final result and you can see the results like at the end of the day. I mean, you're always making progress and you go back and change things. But on the other hand, it's almost like it's an unhealthy thing to like be sitting in a desk like that. And suddenly it's like, what? 8-10 hours have gone by and you don't even realize it. And you're like, oh, I meant to go outside and go for a run, but it got dark. I didn't even notice. So I don't, do you edit?
Yes, I do. And I'm actually in a dark room right now. I've got a new desk and set up whatever, but I believe it can be quite unhealthy. I never tend to do 12-hour days just editing. I do 8 usually, but it is a really kind of weird thing. And I think you're an actress and I come from an acting background. When we're used to being on our feet and potentially used to being in the rehearsal room or being on set and using our bodies as well as our mind in such a way, being in the editing suite or just sitting at a desk it can be very different than what we're used to. I certainly do believe people should go for runs during the day if they're editing, or even go for a walk if they need to get something, or not even if they need to get something, just go for a walk, get up, right, sit there, because it can be very, very unhealthy in some ways and maybe healthy for others, but it depends on the individual and your background and where you come from. But you yourself, as I said, do so many different things, and I can't imagine the pressure and the kind of work ethic you're putting in to do this. But when it comes to the post-production process, after you've been in development, pre-production and production, what is that experience like for you when you did a film like Last Seen in Idaho?
Yeah, I mean, on any film, the post-production is the longer distance part of the run. I mean, well, pre-production can certainly take a significant amount of time as well if we're doing financing. But, you know, people tend to think of movie making as the part on the set, all of that filming. But it's actually much more time in the phase that comes after that in the post-production. So I think that post-production just takes a lot of, you have to self-motivate. You have to go tackle it day after day. When it comes to editing, typically I will edit parts of the film and then Eric will edit parts of the film. We'll do that separately. And then we show each other and give feedback. And then in the later stages, we sit together and we tweak things. We tighten things. We decide we don't need this line or that line, or let's cut out of the scene faster instead of why are we hanging on this shot. So there's the part that's being done alone and then being shown to each other. And then there's, kind of the fine tuning. We've also done test screenings with audiences before to get feedback before we lock the picture in. But yeah, I always think of post-production as this part that, you really just have to have a great work ethic and just come at it piece by piece. And you see the big picture, but you just have day by day have to chip away at it, because even beyond editing, then, we give it to the sound designer, composer in LA, Jeffrey Allen Jones, has worked with us on all five films. And then he does his piece and he's sending it back and we're, kind of giving feedback and doing sessions with him. On this latest film, Eric has colored the entire film. We've worked with colorists on other films in the past. So there are just a lot of thing. I mean, even right now, I need to go list Bigfoot Killed My Wife on IMDb. So I'm just going through all the paperwork to make sure I'm not misspelling anybody's names from on the end credits as well as on IMDb. We're creating the poster art. There's just a lot of things that go on in post-production that if you haven't done post or you're not a filmmaker, you don't even realize all those components. Visual effects as well. There's always visual effects. And we have a visual effect artist named Sean Gleaves who does most of those, and Eric handles small ones. I don't do visual effects. I don't need to add that to the list.
That's something else. And I imagine the amount of effects you've had in some of your films, the nature of them need it. And it's not something that can just be taught overnight or anything like that. But your company, Fire Shoe Productions, what motivated you to start it? And what was the process like? Because many actors, from what I've seen, and actresses start production companies, but they don't quite get over the finishing line, if you get what I mean. I mean, you have your company that has produced stuff and is producing stuff still to this day. So what made you start Fire Shoe Productions?
Well, right before I graduated from college, I knew I wanted to get involved in the Seattle film community. So I showed up to a meeting of filmmakers called Indie Club. And it was actually an organization that Eric had started. And I met him there and I just started... I started acting in some local films, and then Eric and I made a couple shorts together, and then we formed a company and went on and made five features. So that's the nuts and bolts of it. But I really wanted to have a production company because I wanted to have, some control into the stories that I was writing and telling and acting in, and being able to, do that and not just be an actor going out to audition or a writer writing scripts and sending them around to pitch. So really my motivation came, I guess, from the creative end, that I wanted to act and write in these things, but I'm also naturally pretty well suited for producing. I do actually really like budgeting, and I love breaking down scripts into schedules, which oftentimes I'm doing, because we're doing that early on before we even brought on a first AD who would typically do that. So there are parts of it that I actually really, really like. And then there are parts of it that I just do because I want to tell the stories and make the movies from a creative standpoint.
That sounds really good. You've got it all covered, because a lot of people don't like budgeting, or a lot of people get into the budgeting situation and they kind of panic because they realize, yes, we're creative, you're creative or whatever, But without the kind of budgeting side of things, a film's never going to really work. It's going to fall apart in that way. But one of the projects you've made, that the first one I saw, you know, I really, really liked it. So I'll probably mess up the pronunciation here. Bayou Caviar?
Bayou Caviar.
Oh, see, I got it completely wrong, both words.
Okay. It's okay. It's like you should either mess them both up or neither. So you're consistent. So nice so word. Bayou, nice you know, word. Referring to the area down Louisiana. It's shot in New Orleans. That's the setting. That's the location. And then Caviar, the food. But in this case, Bayou Caviar, this is kind of a darker story. Obviously, there's some mobsters and crime people. But Bayou Caviar is what they refer to when these mobsters kill someone and then dispose of the body by feeding it to alligators. Really pleasant stuff.
Yeah, really, really subtle, pleasant stuff. Completely. I understand. But what I find great is that you're able to kind of co-produce and produce and act, whatever. So you've been a part of that film as a producer. How do you feel being a producer not acting in something? Because is there any temptation? Because there is she's a leading actress. I've seen her as a lead in many things. In the film itself. I mean, is there ever a temptation for you to think, oh, you know, maybe I could have played that role, or I would maybe like to jump in and direct in a certain way in certain scenes because of your skills as an actress and as a producer?
Well, I do plan to direct at some point. If I'm on a set, though, and I'm not the director, I mean, it's so important that we just trust in the director as being the captain of the ship. So I'm never like, oh, I should be directing this scene, or I see it this way. Eric and I are very collaborative when he's directing, because oftentimes I've written the script or we've written it together. We're collaborating on those things. But at the end of the day, I mean, he's coming up with that shot list and he's seeing those shots in his head. I oftentimes see the shots in my head when I'm writing the screenplay, but that's just my version of it. And until I decide that, hey, I'm directing it, then that's still always just going to remain what I saw when I was writing. But it's always a very collaborative thing. So in terms of like, if I'm producing like on Bayou Caviar, and yeah, I had like a little bit part in that, but for all intents and purposes, yeah, I wasn't acting in that film. I mean, I love acting. So on the one hand, you might look at a role and go like, oh, that would have been a cool role to play. But on the other hand, different projects, you're suited for different roles and they come to you in different ways. And in that regard, that film came to us with script already written and Cuba attached to direct. And we had the perfect investor for that project. We were involved in financing and logistics and post-production management. And so it was less of a creative endeavor and more of a logistical endeavor in that regard. And and then also that was shot in New Orleans with a union crew, which was larger than the crews that we've, you know, hired and worked with before. So in that regard, it's also different because I'm used to, on a smaller film, you are communicating more one-on-one directly with like almost all the crew members, really, really all of them. And then on a film that has a larger crew with larger departments, you're communicating more with department heads and then they're handling things. Things run really smoothly on a crew of that size that works together a lot. And in that, and in New Orleans, we shot in the summer of 2017. It was a very humid, hot summer. And the industry was starting to not be quite as busy in New Orleans at that time. This is what the crew members were telling us, but it was still a pretty busy city in terms of filmmaking. There was a lot of films coming through. So I felt like they were just like this well-oiled machine that they just would go from one film to the next, really.
So it sounds like when you're producing a film and you've got someone like Cuba Gooding Jr. attached to it and you've got union crew, it's potentially more ideal for you rather than maybe a micro budget style film that Last Scene in Idaho was?
I wouldn't call it more ideal. It's just different because I really do like rolling my sleeves up and being involved in all stages of the process. That is more exhausting and more tiring. I mean, sometimes we weren't on set with Bayou Caviar because we were at the production office or having meetings or doing things to do with the financing end of it. They're just really different experiences. There are pros and cons to both, but I have always been really interested in all aspects of filmmaking. So I definitely don't mind having to juggle a bunch of things. It can be challenging sometimes, though, you know, if you're like dealing with producing things and then you're being called to set to act and you're just trying to like switch modes, or like I'm handing my cell phone off to somebody and going, you know, do this. Like I'm in the middle of a phone call, take it over or whatever.
Yeah. That's understandable. I can see the stress involved when you're doing a project like that and you've got to be here, there in a different way. But tell us about your latest project. I'm excited to hear about this one because it sounds very different as well than your previous stuff that I've seen.
Yeah, every film has been different. Sometimes people ask us, oh, do you guys make a certain genre? And it's like, no. I mean, do you only watch one genre? Because, I mean, I watch all different genres, so I like to write and make all different. So, yeah, but this is the first time we've made like a full-on comedy. It's a comedy called Bigfoot Killed My Wife, and it's about a man who moves to the country from the city with his wife. They get into an argument and he goes into the backyard and he finds her dead and he sees Bigfoot running from the scene. And when he tells people he didn't do it, you know, he gets arrested for the murder and he says Bigfoot did it. Of course, nobody believes him and they think it's a joke and he's, you know, probably going to go to prison for life. So this story is some of his friends, of course, kind of eccentric friends. It's a comedy. Everyone's a little out there, coming to help him search for Bigfoot to try to prove his innocence. What inspired it is that we have a couple projects that we have lined up in the studio system, and the studio system moves incredibly slowly, and there's definitely no guarantee that they will even get the full green light. And so Eric and I were just, we wanted to make something. We said, let's just make something fun. And let's just do another like micro budget film. And let's work with casting crew out of Seattle and Portland. Like oftentimes we fly in actors from LA and we fly in some part of the crew. This case, we're like, let's just make it locally and let's just have fun. So it'll be a comedy. But then we thought, well, we really need something that kind of has, we're not going to put any like name actors in this one. So then we thought, well, what could be kind of a cool hook? And Bigfoot's just, everybody loves Bigfoot. I mean, we love Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And we thought, why don't we do a comedy that involves Bigfoot? And Bigfoot's kind of the famous name or whatever who's in it. And Bigfoot really is in our movie. And the reason I qualify that is I feel like I see a lot of bait and switch stuff when it comes to Bigfoot. Like I just saw an indie film a couple months ago. It had Bigfoot in the title. And Bigfoot's not in it. Like at the very end, you hear Bigfoot, but you never even see him. So just to be clear, they're looking for Bigfoot, and I don't want to give any spoilers away, but Bigfoot is in our movie.
Oh, no, that's fair. That's fair. clearing that up, because sometimes there are situations like that where people are looking for Bigfoot, or not just necessarily looking for Bigfoot, but looking for the character in the title. And you're writing, you've written this, you've produced it, and you've edited it.
Yeah, so Eric and I came up with the story together, and then I wrote the script, and we actually play the two leads in it. There's a bit of an ensemble as well, so there's several main leads in it. But, you know, Eric is the husband who claims that Bigfoot killed his wife, and I am his childhood best friend who holds a secret torch for him. And so we played the leads, and then, yes, he directed it, we produced it, we edited it, he's coloring it, and we're almost finished with it.
And who's going to be distributing this film, if you're allowed to even tell us?
Yeah, we don't have a distributor for this yet. So every film is different in that regards too. There have been some films where we had distribution lined up in advance, or a sales rep or an agency attached. And there have been some where we don't. And then we go out and we find the best home for it. So this is the latter case where we will be talking to streamers and different distribution companies and finding a home for that very soon.
But the distribution process is something I often go through quite a lot and speak to people in great depth, various people in various situations. Do you usually in the development stages, think about how distribution will be done and what your aims and goal are for distribution?
Well, yes, to a degree, because like with The Last Rescue, for example, we had met someone who was very involved in the military reenactment community and had a lot of resources there. And we were aware that like indie war films, you know, would get pretty good distribution worldwide, even without having like a large budget or big stars in them. And so that was something where we were thinking in terms of business, of course, like what type of film could be distributed. And then with Last Scene in Idaho, I mean, there were some decisions that were made in terms of distribution. We were actually, you know, talking with some sales companies at that point, but some of the action elements and things and like the cool cars and things that are seen in it, some of those decisions were incorporated into it in part because literally we were told, like, have, if you have like even a, even like foot chases and you have like cool cars and you have those things, like those really can help when it comes to selling it overseas. And then with Bigfoot Killed My Wife, in some ways, this film has been the one where we just were like, let's just have fun and let's just make a story and not try to insert anything to into it other than Bigfoot. But that wasn't really that we were like, oh gosh, we've got to like work Bigfoot in. We were, when we thought of Bigfoot, we were like, oh, this is perfect because we think Bigfoot's awesome. And so does everyone else. So that will probably help with sales. So that was almost more like just a really, just worked great in both ways.
Oh, completely understand and see that. And so far from what I've seen, your distribution, whoever's doing your distribution is very good. Like I'm over here and I've picked up on some of the stuff you've done. And I know some others who have done so also. So it looks like it's working out really well for you in that regard for certain. But other than Bigfoot, and I know you've got other things in the pipeline, can you tell us about what's coming, what's going to be coming out next from you?
Well, next will be Bigfoot since we're almost done with it. But we do have, yeah, some other projects that are in development as well. And I acted in a horror film in Alabama shortly before the pandemic that hasn't been released yet. And that's called Hellbilly Hollow. I play one of the leads. It's like a slasher horror film. And so I'm kind of excited to see that because, you know, as an I was just an actor in that. So I, other than the trailer that was released, I haven't seen anything. So, you know, you do that experience and then you walk away from it. And then suddenly, you know, 2 years later, you finally get to see it. So yeah, Hellbilly Hollow, is like a fun slap, but pretty gory. Like actually not really the type of film that I typically watch. Okay. A little too scary for me. I will watch it though. At least I know what's coming. So I know if there's, I know a few things I'll probably hide my eyes for.
I see. It must be so relaxing in some ways to not have the pressure of producing or thinking about the edit, or is your script being portrayed in the right way? And maybe even kind of just your experience with the cast as just an actor, that must be very different.
It is different. There are things about it that I absolutely love. You are just completely focused on being an actor. You get even more time to bond with the cast. Mm. And you're not stressed out about if there's something that's going wrong, it's not my fire to put out. It's not my thing to fix. So that is really freeing and really relaxing. On the other hand, sometimes it's a little boring. There's a lot of waiting when you're acting. Like I'm never really bored on sets that are my production company because I'm always busy doing something. You know, when you're sitting in a green room and it's normal, you get called and they think you're going to go to set and they're going to be ready. And then a grip truck is stuck in the mud or they rearrange a schedule last second. And you sit in a green room for, you know, 4 hours, just chatting with the other actors. Sometimes you make up silly little games or whatever. So there's things about it that I like. And then there's things about it where I get really restless and bored too, but that's part of acting. And I always tell that when somebody, you know, just thinks it's really glamorous. And so you're an actor. So you know that a large part of acting actually ends up being the waiting. And then the second they need you, you have to be ready on your A-game. Yeah.
Instantly. It's very fair. And with your experience, do you have an agent for acting and an agent for filmmaking, or are you purely like a kind of indie performer creative that doesn't really want to be held to any account in that way and you're going for it by yourself?
I have an agent in the Seattle area who sends things over to me so that I'll look at or say if I want to be submitted to. But yeah, for the most part, I'm just out, you know, creating my own stuff, or someone's, you know, reaches out to me directly or our company directly if they see something, or I'll, you know, submit directly to something. But yeah, just kind of making things work.
Good, good. So how does that work? I mean, is your agent sending you SAG stuff or?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, great. I mean, they're sending, so there's not, unfortunately for the Seattle area, there's not a ton of stuff here because they bypass us and go north to Canada, to Vancouver, BC. In the 90s, you know, before I was doing any of this, Seattle was, you know, a really desirable filmmaking area, but we don't have the tax incentives that a lot of the states have. So when we shot Bayou Caviar down in New Orleans, there was really two reasons we did that. One, Louisiana has really great tax incentives. And when I say that, I'm talking about where you can use tax incentives to contribute to your overall budget by infusing money into the economy. So through your tracking of your budget, you're showing that we're paying for crew and we're paying for hotels and resources and food. And then you get tax incentives back. So the Washington tax incentive, you know, bucket is very small compared to a lot of states. And then just north of us in Vancouver, BC, which is maybe like an hour across the border, they have great tax incentives. So there's all these films that are set in Seattle that you'll watch, and they'll get like some cutaway shots and they'll get some scenic shots of the Space Needle. But they really shoot very little films here. So a lot of the films that are in this area are like homegrown films. So there's, you know, commercial stuff, but I don't really submit for commercial acting. I'm just really busy with what we're putting together. And I find there's so many actors that go out for that, that it's just the amount of time you spend like driving to an audition or making your taped audition. It's just, I'm just not interested in doing it, I guess. So I'm really only interested in, I guess, film and TV when it comes to acting.
I completely understand what you mean. It's almost like you've given yourself the power to continue as a creative rather than waiting for other people or waiting for other things in that way as an actress, driving to auditions and getting self-tapes done and maybe not having the experiences that you would like to. So really take my hat off to you for that.
Well, I see that. Thank you. I see that you're a filmmaker. And actually, I watched your short film, Grapes, and I really loved it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I thought it was really powerful, especially the moment where the main character is, you know, pleading to get into the club, you know, and it was sad. I was tearing up, and then she had a line that was really funny and I was laughing, and then it was poignant and moving again. And so I thought it was really well done.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for watching. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I was a little curious about you because you were the director of that, but you also come from an acting background. So are you focused more on directing now, or are you still on the acting train as well, doing both, and it just depends on the project?
No, I'm completely directing now. In terms of film, I don't act anymore. The time it was taking up for the results that I was getting was so different. I just basically couldn't continue. And I'm a bit of a self-starter in many ways. So I found myself maybe waiting for my agent to give me a call. And if she's not giving me a call, I'm just kind of in limbo, if that makes sense. I was dedicating myself to certain projects I was filming and writing, but I felt I couldn't completely be dedicated because, for example, one day I was holding rehearsals with two actresses in the scene and my agent said, okay, I've got an audition for you today. And it was something I really didn't want. So, you're one foot in, you're one foot out. Yeah.
Right. And you feel like you have to say yes, because, you know, depending on your relationship with your agent, there's a little bit of an expectation like, well, hey, are you doing this or not? So I don't have that type of relationship with the agent that sends me stuff. Like, she gets that we are just also doing our own stuff. But that's not typical. You know, you probably feel like, did you feel like you have to do it? Otherwise you're not showing that you're a serious actor, right?
Oh yeah. I had to do it. And my agent was fine, but it was in that type of situation. And I see where she's coming from, because she would be in a situation where she's saying to herself, I'm working hard to get you through the door. Right. And I need you to appreciate that and get yourself through the door. But my problem was, that's true, but the doors I'm going through are not the doors I want to open.
Right.
So, you know, something has to give. And we had a really sensible conversation near the end, and it was fine. You know, great. I moved one way, you know, and she kept on being an agent. She's got some great talent on her books, but ultimately it's a lot more rewarding and I feel a lot more creative not acting, but doing stuff behind the camera, such as yourself, and, you know, experiencing editing, experiencing writing, experiencing being on set, experiencing budgeting and seeing how things come together. And by doing so, it's given me a really great insight into some of the films I was in as an actor and why they didn't work, because certain people were behaving in certain ways, and filmmaking isn't for everyone, I guess.
Right. It's not for everyone, but you know, certainly sometimes the people that want to do it, and this is the minority, but they want to do it for the wrong reason, because they think like, oh, this is really cool, and like, I'll get attention for doing this. So it's like an ego thing. But that's sort of like the exact reason why you shouldn't do it, because it's a lot of hard work and you need to be very collaborative with people and flexible and not have that ego. So,
and having stories that you want to tell for various different reasons, like you said about, you know, the Bigfoot film, it's like you've got to that place with your partner professionally and personally, where you want to do that story. It sounds great. It sounds fun. And you just have that control. Whereas acting wise, I might be in a situation where I'm with in a play or a film or whatever. And the story is interesting, but the people in control are not really from the situation. They haven't really experienced the story. So it falls flat. Mm-hmm. And that can be kind of soul destroying if you think, well, I've put a lot of time and effort into this and what have I got to show for it? I've made films myself, short films that I cringe when I watch them. But at the same point, I think, okay, it was a learning experience. It's fun.
It's always a learning experience. You can't expect anything to be perfect because you're always growing, but it can be hard sometimes. Like I have both experiences. Like I look back at stuff we've made in the past and I can feel really critical because I can see how far I've come and I would do this differently now. On the other hand, I also know oftentimes what we are up against in terms of time or budget. Mm. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like I'm so impressed we even did this. This was like so much work and we didn't have, you know, $20 million and, yeah. You know, just this unlimited, you know, resources. And then the other thing that's interesting is when you edit, you know, you edit with this footage that's like not colored and you edit with rough sound. And that is what is always in my memory. So the other day I actually saw part of one of our films on streaming and I was like, oh my gosh, this looks really good. Because in my mind, I still see it. You know, for the hundreds of thousands of times you saw it with like not colored and like rough, crappy sound. And suddenly you're like, this sounds beautiful. Like, you know, so it's actually nice sometimes to remember like, oh, the vision that I have in my head, like burned into my head, isn't the final thing we release. Cause you only really watch that final version a handful of times. Like there is a theater premiere and then, you know, you have to go through quality control and you have to watch it a few times and make sure there isn't any issues. But then after that, you know, you've seen it so many times, you don't sit down and watch it for fun, not for several years at least.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Years and years and years. And I completely agree with you on seeing footage. Cause I remember buying a Blackmagic pocket cinema camera and putting it on the profile you need to, it's a desaturated image. I can't remember the Blackmagic picture profile, but it's like S-Log, for example, if you're filming a film on a Sony camera and just seeing that kind of flat, gray image and thinking, ugh, I've paid all of this money for this camera and that's the image.
Right, like, what's wrong with it?
Yeah, and the scratch sound was more than awful. I can't even explain how bad it is on a Blackmagic pocket cinema camera. But putting it in Premiere Pro or After Effects, I can't remember which software I use, and you start to grade it, you start to see, oh, okay, this is, but to be honest, it wasn't me. I didn't grade it. Someone else started to grade the project and you start to understand and think about how high the quality can be. But initially, you know, at first, when I think of some of the projects that were shot on that camera, I think of that gray, flat, desaturated, horrible look, but we need it. We need the color space to color.
Right. And then you see it, the final product again, and you are like, oh, you're so refreshed. Like, oh, thank goodness. That's right. That's not how it looks in my head. Like what's in my head isn't what it actually looks like.
You're dead right. And your colorist, he's really good. You've got a long relationship with him or her. Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
So we, two of our films were shot by a really talented cinematographer named Brian Jansen, who was also a colorist. So he was coloring, or he colored afterwards, but, you know, and had it, that in his mind as well when it came to lighting and all the shooting. Eric also is a colorist as well. He just hasn't colored any of our features because coloring takes a lot of time. And if a cinematographer is a great colorist and wants to do it, go for it. But in Bigfoot Killed My Wife, Eric is doing the coloring and it looks phenomenal. And he's put in so many hours. And, you know, I just come in sometimes and give feedback and, you know, sometimes too, similar to editing, I think I'm imagining this since I don't color, but you sit there and you see it over and over again. And sometimes I think colorists can lose perspective. It's also why they have all their technical tools to also look at the numbers to actually know, because when you stare at a screen so long and then you see one next to the other, you kind of can lose perspective. So sometimes he calls me and he's like, look at this, you know, just wants my feedback of someone who's just walked into the room and is seeing it for the first time.
Oh, completely. You know, the RGB graphs and things like that, they got to have that. Because their eyes can just kind of fall asleep. That's a bad way to put it, but I completely understand. Like we said about editing for hours and hours, if you're coloring for hours and hours, you're surely not going to be able to see things the right way for a part of the time, if that's because that's quite intense, I think. thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. It was great speaking to you and learning about your process and your company and your films, of course. So I really appreciate it. And I hope Bigfoot Killed My Wife is available to watch in the UK sooner rather than later.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It was a really interesting conversation. I enjoyed it a lot.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please do hit the subscribe button or leave a review on iTunes.
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Madenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story, as he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.